Hello and welcome to this special edition of Irreligiosophy. We have a special guest here, Dr. Robert Price. I have been following Dr. Price. I've kind of been stalking him ever since he was on Infidel Guy and the Bible Geek, so I'm really excited.
Truth be told, I thought he scared him off when Charlie sent him this real fanboyish email, and I thought, God, that guy's never going to come on our show after seeing that.
But we made it. He's on. And Dr. Price, you like to be called Dr. Price, or what should we call you?
Bob is fine.
Bob's fine? Let's start. Now, you started out as a fundamentalist Christian, is that right?
Hallelujah.
What changed your mind?
Well, I got into the study of the Bible in pretty minute detail, and I began to notice that some of the stuff I said at the Baptist church I attended didn't seem to have much scriptural support, and that made me a little suspicious, but redoubled my attention to the text. And then I got into apologetics. This is when I was, I was just getting into college, and I got involved with an InterVarsity Christian Fellowship group there and read all of their interesting books about how the faith is true and has the best perspective on everything, and I really thoroughly enjoyed that, but I found that the more I got into trying to defend the faith, the more I was unable to just relax and have faith anymore. I realized if you're going to go back and forth on the battlefield of argument, even just inside your own head, faith is really much more difficult to come by. I felt like I did not dare to be dishonest and try arguments on people to get them to believe in Christ or whatever that I didn't think were cogent, and I knew there were a lot of silly ones out there, and that, so I felt like I had to kind of set aside my faith to evaluate the arguments, and this pretty much poisoned the whole thing, though I was glad it did, and eventually I found that there was just a lot of very important data that none of the apologists I read had ever brought up, and by contrast, there was a lot that the liberal and skeptical scholars I had read refutations of, there was a lot that they had to say that was quite cogent and just ignored in what I had read. And so I was halfway through my master's degree in New Testament at Gordon-Conwell Seminary in 77 when I just realized the whole evangelical Christian thing just does not hold water. It just doesn't work. It's self-contradictory in every way. I wasn't opposed to believing in God or the supernatural or whatever, but just this just seemed to me to be a house of cards. So I started reading a lot of biblical critics and other theologians like Paul Tillich and process theology and all sorts of stuff. And I wound up being kind of a religiously friendly agnostic. I felt like the supernatural probably, it was just not enough reason to positively believe that. Who knows what's going on in the universe, but there's just no reason to affirm this. And yet I thought, well, spirituality seems to be a healthy thing. And after really decades now, I guess I still feel that way. I go to church because it's an aesthetic and sort of transcendent sort of experience that gives me perspective I wouldn't get the rest of the week, but it's kind of a matter of Coleridge's temporary willing suspension of disbelief. It's not really, I don't think religion has anything to do anymore with actually believing dubious assertions that can never be proved. That's probably just a big mistake way back, and the benefits of it don't depend upon that. And so I find myself going to the Episcopal Church and speaking at atheist conferences with no inconsistency.
Yeah, that was my next question. What type of church? So it's an Episcopal Church. Those guys are pretty forward-thinking. They have, I think there's a big argument between the was it the European or African Episcopalian Church and the American one about ordaining women and homosexuals to the priesthood? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of really arch traditionalist ex-missionary churches in the Anglican communion that are in sub-Saharan Africa, and they're basically fundamentalists in theology. And there's a wing of the American church that likes that and has actually separated itself from the Episcopal Church USA to go under the supervision of some of these African bishops. And Rwanda, I know, is a big one for that. And I think throw birds of a feather flock together. If they're happier there, I'm glad. I don't want them trying to force fundamentalism on the rest of us in the church.
Well, I'm kind of curious. You bring up that you still go to church, and I'm pretty sure if Charlie and I ever went to church, we would be stoned. But do you ever get reactions where people are like, oh, you're that guy?
Well, I don't seem to. When I had gone to this church for about 3 years back in the mid-'80s when I taught at a Baptist college down here, and people knew I had critical views, and a lot of people came to discussion groups that I led and so forth, so nobody seemed to mind. Then I went back up to New Jersey for a dozen years, and then I worked first for a liberal Baptist church I pastored. Then I worked for a few years for the Center for Inquiry, the Paul Kurtz group, but then I moved back down here with my family and decided to go to church again. Well, they made a big deal of in their newsletter welcoming me back and reproducing a lot of stuff from some secular humanist newsletter about me. I thought, oh boy, why'd they do this? But nobody ever gave a peep about that if they understood what they were reading. And I assume they did. They made nothing of it, and I get along fine with everybody.
Yeah, the Episcopalian church is a little different than the Mormon church, Leighton. We're in Utah. Oh. We're surrounded by Mormons. They're a
well,
little
good folks,
that's
for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I'm pretty sure if we walked into any church, you and I, we would be stoned, Charlie. That's just
no
the bottom
way.
Line.
Episcopalians and Unitarians, those guys aren't stoning anybody.
Well, maybe they just spit on us when we walked in.
They tend to be. They might shrug their shoulders in mild disapproval, but I think they're pretty open.
That could be a new mode of baptism in Unitarianism.
Oh God.
Well, hey, when I read The Incredible Shrinking Son of Man, it was a really eye-opening experience to me. Leighton and I have done a podcast about pagan precursors to Old Testament and New Testament stuff, but when I read the book, I was stunned by how much the New Testament stuff was cribbed from the Old Testament.
Oh, yeah, that is amazing, yeah.
Never thought about that before. And, I mean, you bring up really specific examples of where I think Mark has stitched together three things and a bunch of the stuff from the crucifixion, because no one apparently there, or there was no tradition, and so they just all kind of made stuff up, and the best place to make it up, I guess, to make it sound authentic was to go to the Old Testament.
Yeah, Earl Doherty pointed this out in his great book, The Jesus Puzzle, that he just zeroes in on one passage in 1 Corinthians 15 where it appears to be a kind of a liturgy or creed or formula being quoted by the author. He died for our sins in accordance with the scriptures, etc., and then rose in accordance with the scriptures. And most people had always taken this to mean that these events were prophesied whether or not we knew to expect them, but now in the event, having seen Jesus crucified and visions of him raised from the dead, at least now we realize that these things were prophesied. We should have been looking for them. Well, Doherty said, it doesn't look that way to me. It looks as if what the writer means is we know that he died and rose because it says so in the Old Testament. And I thought, well, that's for some of these details, yes. Like, where does Matthew get the idea Jesus was sold out for 30 pieces of silver? It's not in Mark, his source material. Well, what do you know? He got it out of Zechariah chapter 12. He just plucked it out of context.
Right.
And so I knew some of that had gone on. How did Matthew know Jesus and his family went to Egypt? Was there a tradition to that effect? No, probably not. He just kind of saw my son in Hosea 11:1 and said, oh, boy, that's got to be another coded prophecy. So the son of God, Jesus, must have gone to Egypt and come back. Well, I knew that it happened some, but once I began reading several books that went into great detail about Old Testament sources, like Randall Helms's book, Gospel Fictions, I found that no one of them covered all the ground, but between these seven or eight books, none of which were trying to say the whole thing came out of the Old Testament, they all had such cogent arguments for virtually every story in the Gospel and Acts. I was really shocked. I thought, yeah, it just seems like the easier conclusion to say that they simply rewrote the Old Testament to make a new one.
Right. I was amazed. Matthew is an interesting source. He's the one that read that scripture literally, where and he said that Jesus entered into Jerusalem sitting on two donkeys. Is that right?
Yeah. That makes a perverse kind of sense, oddly enough, in that we know from other examples that the rabbinical scholars, though they still understood the Hebrew parallelism and even used it themselves in their own writings, you know, where you say the same thing two ways,
right.
It gives it a nice ring, they didn't seem to care about that when they were interpreting scripture, and they would try to, like the Kabbalah people later on, they were trying to wring anything they could out of the text, and so they would not regard it as the same thing said twice, but two different things. And so Matthew is interpreting this just the way the rabbis did. On the colt and the foal of an ass, two animals somehow. How? Well, he doesn't care. He's just saying, yeah, it happened all right.
Right, doesn't matter because it was in the scripture, so it had to happen.
Yeah, so sort of rodeo riding, I guess. But.
Right.
Well, my big burning question is there any creativity in Christianity? Because the more I research this stuff, the more I discover it was either plagiarized from the Old Testament or it was plagiarized from an earlier civilization.
But that's probably true of almost everything in every religion and literature, intertextuality, as they call it. To me, the New Testament versions are usually more effective, though I know that's very subjective, than a lot of the stuff in the Old. But there's at least a brand new spin on it that makes it just as good. And I think the creativity lies in the redaction. I began to think this way. I'm a big fan of H.P. Lovecraft, and I read his stories before almost any other horror stories. But then later, I began to read some of the authors that he had read, and now, like my favorite Lovecraft story, The Dunwich Horror, I can divide that up and tell you about eight different stories that he borrowed major things from, and yet it doesn't hurt the originality. His story is much more than the sum of its parts. So I figure creativity, it's like God in the old creation myths. He doesn't create out of nothing, not even in the Bible, but takes pre-existent matter and shapes it into a cosmos. So that doesn't really bother me, though it does serve to explode the myth that here it is just de novo, unique and right from the mouth of God.
Right, certainly. And it tends to bother us more as modern authors because we're really sensitive to the criticism of plagiarism, but that criticism didn't really exist back then. I mean, this is what these guys did. They would take myths from other religions in Babylon, for example, the Enuma Elish or the Epic of Gilgamesh for the Noah flood story, and they'd kind of mold them because they sounded interesting and they were effective in conveying their message, and they'd mold them into the Jewish sort of tradition so it would be effective for them. I mean, that's what they did.
Yeah. It's just not a question. You have to ask what they seem to have thought they were doing.
Right.
And ultimately, even if they were making a buck off it, which is impossible, the motive hardly matters. We don't have telepathy. We're just dealing with texts however they got there. And it's kind of fun to see how they got there sometimes, but as to the why, we can't know it, and it doesn't make any difference. I saw this thing on TV. There's this series. I remember Gene Scott, the profane, cigar-chomping evangelist. He was really a wild character. And I remember him having some cartoon thing, kill a pissant for Jesus on the show. Very strange. Well, he croaked, but his wife runs the thing now, and she's an ex-porn star. And she's very erudite. She's got whiteboards filled with Greek and Hebrew, and she's explaining to the audience what the text means. Astonishing. She said, she's talking about the flood story once, and said that, well, some people say this was borrowed from the Gilgamesh epic or something, but that's absurd because God doesn't copy. Boy, that's a great way of just short-circuiting the whole thing. And the gal is so learned, but so childish in her perspective.
Absolutely.
And so many fundies are.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's the thing that it destroys. It destroys fundamentalist Christianity, that the Bible is a literal truth. I mean, if honestly, if you know anything about this stuff and you believe the Bible is a literal truth, you're going to have to believe in ancient Egyptian Osiris myths, where the sacrament came from. You have to believe in Babylonian mythology, Sumerian stuff. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, that's actually what I was trying to get after is,
yeah.
You pointed it out perfectly, Bob, and I mean, just all of these are basically built upon the same story, but I think the most important thing that came out of your discussion there is that you are a horror fan just like Charlie and I, and you really need to come out here for Halloween.
Yeah, every...
that'd be great.
Every year,
you're in Utah. Yeah,
we're in Utah.
Yeah.
Every year we convert my house and my yard around it into this spook alley. And this year it's going to be fantastic. We got a bunch of all new stuff. It's going to be wonderful.
Oh, boy, with the angel Moroni peeking out to scare the kids.
Yeah, actually, we got a brand new temple just a couple miles from us.
Oh, boy. Oh, I love Utah. I've been out there. I used to go out there once a year for the Book of Mormon roundtable that we had at BYU until the guy that organized it was fired.
Yeah, that's not surprising. Was that in the September 6th? Did he get purged?
What's that?
Did he get purged in the September 6th, where they fired a bunch of feminists and excommunicated a bunch of scholars?
Hear about that. This would have been maybe 2 years ago.
Oh, so
oh,
that
okay.
was a
no,
lot later.
No, it wasn't the September.
Oh, geez, he had another purge. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, Mormons don't like scholarship a whole lot.
Well, the funny thing is, I'm still waiting for him to purge me. I mean, I can't tell you how irreverent I am on this show, but for some reason, they just want to keep me in their roles.
They're not listening. Mm. But they also like to inflate their member roles for, you know, propaganda purposes. Bob, you're also a member of the Jesus Seminar. Could you explain a little bit about that and how it works and what it is?
Well, back in 82... Bob Funk, Robert W. Funk, may rest in peace, a great, great guy. He had been a boy evangelist and got that out of his system and became a really innovative New Testament scholar and grammarian, just incredible. He and John Dominic Crossan decided that it was about time that historical Jesus studies, which have been going on for a couple of centuries, be brought out of the ivory tower and kind of forced on the public awareness. And a lot of colleagues didn't care much for that and kind of knifed Funk in the back, making it look like the Jesus Seminar was a bunch of dangerous lunatics when, in fact, they were just saying the same thing mainstream scholarship always had,
right,
but certain people wanted to keep under wraps so as to reduce controversy. Well, what they decided to do was to get to do with the Gospels as histories what the United Bible Society does periodically, trying to come up with a critical text comparing all the different New Testament manuscripts, because there are thousands of them, and they're usually minor, but loads of little disagreements and hard to tell sometimes. Well, you know, a whole bunch of manuscripts have this phrase, a whole bunch don't. How do you tell? And they debate the pros and cons. And as a result, you'll see footnotes at the bottom of the Greek New Testament where it gives passages an A, B, C, or D rating. Like most of it would be A, yeah, this is certainly original to the text, but then you come up with something like Jesus is refused entrance into a village because they're headed towards Samaria, and the James and John say, do you want us to call down fire from heaven on them as Elijah did? And Jesus rebukes them, and they went on to another place. Well, some manuscripts have Jesus say, you don't know what sort of spirit you belong to. The Son of Man came to save men's lives, not to destroy them. Well, that's pretty good. It would make sense if it was original, but it would make sense if somebody just felt the rebuke should be supplied, so they made it up. There's no way to know, and so they might give that one a C rating. Could be. It's a toss-up. So what Funk and Crossan came up with was, let's look first at the sayings of Jesus in the four Gospels and Thomas, and then when we're done with that, the stories about Jesus, and debate whether we think these really go back to Jesus. Did he really do it? Did he really say it? And if it seems clear that he did, okay, it gets a red mark, and there was the famous voting with the different colored beads you'd put in the tray, and they'd count them up after extensive debate. And if it could be that, yeah, it sounds like what Jesus would have said based on the red stuff, but there are some problems, he might have said it. Okay, that gets a pink. If it's possible he said it, but there's some doubt, we give it a gray. If there's no way he said it, like it's plainly anachronistic or something, then that gets a black. And so they did color-coded books with this material. And so they just did it with colors, not letters, but the same basic methodology that committees of scholars had done with text criticism. Nothing controversial or odd about it, except the results, really, that they wound up thinking that only 18% of either category actually went back to Jesus. I think that is hopelessly optimistic. Yeah. But of course, most people just believe everything in there is literally true, so this seems scandalous to them.
Sure, the entire thesis of the incredible shrinking Son of Man was stripping away a bunch of stuff, or at least giving doubts as to what actually could have gone back to Jesus, and they're amazingly little.
Yeah, that's what astounds me.
Not even the name. We can't be certain of the crucifixion. We can't be certain of the birth. I mean, the miracles, certainly we can't be, we have faith in that. But it's absolutely amazing how little of that isn't a result of either arguments that are going on between various Christian sects Christian sects with the pagan world, or Jews and Christian sects, or even John the Baptist and Jesus. I had no idea before I read this book that there wasn't even an argument between Jesus and John the Baptist sects. That was fascinating to me.
Yeah, of course, almost everything in there really goes back to David Friedrich Strauss, Rudolf Bultmann, and others. I have my own spin on a few things, but I always try to give credit where credit is due. And Strauss pointed this thing out, that how could John have thought Jesus was the one to believe when he maintained his own sect with different prayers and rituals, fasting and all that. It would have to be right, like it is in the Gospel of John, which is wholly rewritten, where he says, look, forget about me, go follow this guy.
And yet there's still a sect persisting at least into the second century, right? They were having these arguments well into the second century.
Yeah, who believe that they would say, look, don't you have Jesus saying that our guy John the Baptist is the greatest of men born to women? Well, that's got to include himself, doesn't it? Wasn't he saying John is his superior? Well, then there you go. Who's the Messiah? It's got to be John. And,
right.
And sure enough, there is anxiety over that kind of thing in the Gospels, because someone seems to have appended to that John, whoever's the least in the kingdom of God, the Christian regime, is greater than John.
Absolutely.
I mean, that is an attacked on thing by Christians to answer that criticism. It just seems so obvious.
And that almost seems to supply a reason for the virgin birth, aside from all the other sons of God who were born of virgins. But then they can answer to the sect of John, well, Jesus wasn't born of a woman, so therefore.
Well, Marcion did say that. The virgin birth doctrine has him born of a woman, just not of a man. But Marcion, earlier than the Gospels, I think, he does have Jesus simply descend from heaven in a kind of celestial body that appeared to be human flesh, and he's in adult form. And so he believed, yes, Jesus was not born of any parents. And so that could have figured into that debate.
There was a proto-evangelion of James also that had Mary giving birth in a cave, but this sort of cloud escaping from her, leaving her hymen intact, so she was a virgin even after giving birth
to Jesus. That's actually my favorite right there. That's my favorite.
That's probably the earliest statement of the perpetual virginity of Mary doctrine that the Catholic Church still promotes.
One of my favorite, you know, the midwife hears about it on the road and she goes, I can't believe this. So she goes into the cave and she examines Mary and confirms it.
Yep. Yeah, and that's really amazing stuff, because the perpetual virginity of Mary does fit with docetism and is incompatible with the opposite view that Jesus was really in the flesh. Docetism, which just means apparentism or seemingism, from dokeo, to seem, that's like this view that Marcion and others had, that Jesus didn't really have a fleshly body. It's just that, obviously, to communicate with human beings, he had to appear to have.
Right, very similar to...
That's all it was.
Very similar to some of the Gnostic Gospels, where they have Jesus, I guess, laughing as they crucify the wrong guy, right? Like he's tricked them into crucifying the wrong guy.
To their eyes, I'm being crucified down there on the cross of wood, but you know better, John. In fact, in that same text, the preaching of John, part of the Acts of John, it couldn't be any clearer. John says, well, let me tell you what it was like to follow Jesus. I noticed he left no footprints in the sand. I noticed when I sat beside him at the table, he ate no food. I would touch him and my hand would pass through him, or it would be like striking steel, and you could never tell which. Once, when he thought everybody was asleep, he stood up, and down from heaven comes another like him and says, how's it going with your disciples? And he said, well, not very well. What do you expect? They're only men. Astonishing. Like, whoever wrote this certainly did not believe Jesus was a flesh and blood human, and that's kind of consistent with the idea that Mary's hymen was unbroken.
Right.
He couldn't have actually been born.
Right.
Surprising they kept that in the story.
He's not a man.
You know, the interesting thing is I mean, even about another man coming down and speaking to Jesus, it actually makes me think of Didymus Thomas Jude. And this is a theory that Charlie and I have brought up, and we've just only scratched the surface bringing it up on Irreligiosophy. But Didymus is the Greek for twin. Thomas is the Hebrew for twin. And Jude, of course, this is doubting Thomas. And so it's kind of been a theory Charlie and I have tossed back and forth, that Jesus had a twin, and possibly when Jesus was crucified, Jude was brought forth and kind of displayed to the disciples and such as the guy, hey, you know, Jesus really isn't dead. Because, I mean, after he's dead, what do you do at that point? So, yeah, I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, there's an entire gospel of is it the gospel of Thomas where he goes to
Judas
India?
Thomas, Judas Didymus Thomas.
Right, and he's actually mistaken for Jesus because he is Jesus' twin, literally in that gospel.
Oh, now that's the Acts of Thomas.
Is that the Acts of Thomas?
Acts.
In the Gospel of Thomas, it's made clear that he is equal to Jesus because he's shared the same enlightenment. And then in the Book of Thomas the Contender, which is partly based on that, it actually says, Jesus says to him, you are said to be my twin, but of course the likeness is spiritual. But the brothers of Jesus include a Jude, or Judas, or Judah, same thing. So he's got a brother named that, and Thomas is somebody's twin brother. So that's the inference they drew in the New Testament period. Well, I was just reading a great book called The Creation of the Christ by Paul Louis Couchot, written in the 20s. He brought this theory up, and he said that, it's been suggested that the reason you have the Doubting Thomas story in John 20 right after the appearance to the apostles in general, without saying Thomas wasn't there. First, they're just the disciples are there. He appears just like Luke 24. And then it says, well, Thomas was out getting the pizza when Jesus appeared. And so he said, hey, guess what? The Lord is risen. He's here. He says, look, I'm sorry. I'm not believing that until I can check out the wounds. And then sure enough, 8 days later, here he is again. Couchot says that the point of this seems to be to erase the doubt, to undercut the criticism that, Jesus wasn't risen. It was just his twin brother that played the role. So that is a theory that you don't hear discussed much, but a pretty good one.
Yeah, in your book, there's an interesting theory where in Mark, there's this passage where some of the people who are watching Jesus being crucified stick a sponge on the end of a spear, and it's filled with vinegar, and they give it to him to drink, and he dies really quickly after that. So maybe it was, you know, laced with some sort of drug or something, and Joseph of Arimathea gets, you know, permission to get Jesus' body down. They put it in the tomb, and, you know, later he revives, and he's not dead at all. He never died on the cross at all.
Yeah, this is an old theory, too, and my theory is not so much that that may be what happened to Jesus, though it's possible, but that since this is just like what happens to crucified heroes in contemporary novels, and there are loads of clues about it, once you know what to look for in the Gospels, that all four Gospels seem to presuppose a hero story version in which Jesus is delivered from the cross. He's crucified, but not killed. And so that's the triumph. After all, like, look at Jesus in Gethsemane. He's praying that God will spare him the death on the cross. He says, of course, I'll do whatever you say. Well, does it make sense that the Father's just, you know, tough nookies you're going through with? I mean, isn't that a kind of a shoe dropping that leads you to suspect something else? Jesus is on the cross, and his detractors are saying, some Savior, he couldn't even save himself. Let him come down from the cross alive, and then we'll believe. You stupid bastards, that's exactly what's going to happen, et cetera, et cetera. Why is he buried with a rich man? Nobody ever explains that, but surely the reason is, as it is in these various novels, like Kyrias and Caliraway, a famous novel back then, it's to provide narrative motivation for tomb robbers to see this opulent tomb sealed up. I say, oh, let's go break in. There must be all kinds of great funerary goods in there, like the pharaohs. And then they break in and find out, well, there's not, but there's this person reviving. Oh, my God, what are we going to do now? We got witnesses. Let's take them with us. And surely that's what was going to happen. That explains how Jesus wasn't abandoned in the tomb, and so on and so on. So I'm just convinced that there was this original version of the story in which Jesus didn't die on the cross. Whatever happened to the real Jesus, if there was one, who knows?
And there is precedent for that in the Old Testament. I mean, basically, Abraham demonstrated a willingness to sacrifice his son Isaac. And because of that willingness, God said, hey, you're off the hook. You don't have to do it.
You're very sharp. That's right. And oddly enough, there are rabbinic statements implying that some of the rabbis, surprisingly late in the day, were reading some version of Genesis in which Abraham did kill him. And it says, well, we know that the ashes of Isaac or the blood of Isaac or whatever enriched the ground, and implying it was some sort of a Baal character dying and rising, perhaps, as Hebrews intimates. And that his
That's fascinating.
Willing... Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, he just said that was fascinating.
And, of course, there's precedence for that, too. In the Old Testament, there was a story about a king who prayed to God that if he'd win this battle, he'd sacrifice the first thing that greeted him when he came back. And, you know,
Jephthah.
Was expecting that to be his dog, but it turned out to be his daughter, and he ended up having to kill her, and he had to go through with that. He wasn't let off the hook.
And some people have tried to say, oh, no, and explain it away. I don't know. I don't remember how anymore, but it's interesting that you've got, and now if what the rabbis are reading is the original version, then what we are reading is a later correction where he escapes from the cross because they found it unseemly. Well, same thing happened with, you know, the story you just mentioned with Jephthah and his daughter. It's paralleled in the Iliad with Agamemnon sacrificing his daughter Iphigenia so that Athena will allow the wind to blow and they can leave the harbor. Well, somebody didn't like that, and I think it's in Ovid's version. Athena can't bring herself to allow this, so at the last minute she takes a doe and makes her look human and whisks the real Iphigenia away. And the same thing with Zeus. His father, the Titan Kronos, is eating all of his offspring for fear they'll grow up and usurp his throne, but Gaia manages to conspire with Rhea, Zeus's mother, to make it look like his dad was eating him, but he whisked him away, just like in Revelation chapter 12, to a faraway island. So this cheating death thing is incredibly old and goes way back.
And of course, the earliest versions of Mark that we have don't have the last 12 or 14 verses where Jesus makes his post-resurrection appearance. You know, the earliest manuscripts we have the stone being rolled away and the women seeing an empty tomb, and then it just ends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that ending never really made sense to me until I read your book, and I thought, hey, this could have been an additional story where Jesus kind of revives and emerges from the tomb, and then the women come, and the tomb is empty.
Yeah, and even if you don't wheel that into the thing, as Charles Talbert pointed out, the end of Mark with no appearance of Jesus would have made sense to an ancient reader because there were plenty of stories like that where Empedocles or Romulus or one or another had apparently been killed, but nobody could find any trace of the body, and then a heavenly voice told them that, oh, no, he's been taken up to heaven to become one of the gods. And you might see him again, but you might not. It didn't matter as long as there was an angelic voice telling that. And so you wouldn't have needed any resurrection appearance. But the other gospel writers apparently weren't looking at it that way and decided to tack on their own endings. Okay. And to me, you just can't get around the fact that to have the women, after all, obey what the young man or the angel says to do, it's not merely to continue the story, it is to reverse it. You have to hammer in a new hook to hang anything else on. So the notion of resurrection appearances doesn't just supplement Mark, it grossly contradicts Mark. I don't think anybody's ever really given sufficient weight to that.
Another interesting possibility is I was reading Dawkins or Hitchens, one of the New Atheists, and they were talking about cargo cult, one of the cargo cults in South America or the islands. And they had anticipated that this ghost ship would come back and it would give a bunch of things, and the ghost would go throughout the island and give a bunch of treasures to the tribe. And it actually flipped from in a single generation. From anticipating, everyone's anticipating, and stories about this ghost ship are spreading around, anticipating his return, to, I think by 1930, the story had flipped to, hey, the ghost ship had come back. You know, it already came.
Do they mention that? I had never heard that before. I did in an article in Secular Nation, I think it was, because there is an instance where they believe the big boat suddenly had come back.
Yeah, I read that in God Delusion. It was in Dawkins' God Delusion.
Yeah, that's actually a fascinating piece right there.
Right, so the original ending of Mark could have been it. You know, it could have been that they were just anticipating the return of Jesus, and they were anticipating, and then like 20 years later, all of a sudden, bam, didn't you know? Jesus already came back. It already happened.
And that's why you have the resurrection happening to small groups behind closed doors or out in the remote the lakeside and all that. Otherwise, you know, if it would have happened the way anybody would want it to, there'd be Jesus showing up in the Sanhedrin and before Pilate. In fact, this guy, I can't think of his name, who wrote the Arco volume in the early 20th century, he wrote all these fake records of the Sanhedrin and Pilate and stuff that he claimed he found in the Vatican Library, Asa Mahan, I think it was. And that's what would have happened, presumably, but if you have these lame things, it's like, you say John the Baptist was supposed to precede the Messiah. I mean, Elijah was supposed to precede the Messiah. We didn't see him. And what have you got? Well, actually, it was figured, if you see, it was John the Baptist. Oh, yeah, right. No, it was literal, but there were only four people there to see him. Too bad you weren't there.
Yeah, oops.
It also explains why, you know, Josephus, for example, who grew up in Galilee in the generation after Jesus, seems to have no idea about any of these events or any of these miracles, right?
Yeah, definitely Josephus, if not anybody else.
I don't know, but to me, it's hard to say. Like, there are probably all kinds of weird things going on that still might not have come to his notice, but I think Acts actually is based partly on Josephus, it's pretty clear that the Day of Pentecost thing is completely a theological creation. For one thing, it misunderstands what speaking in tongues is if you have it right in 1 Corinthians. It's not speaking other human languages, but Luke changes it as if it were in order to foreshadow the Gentile mission, which is his big concern. And yet, if it had happened, where Peter says, yeah, this blessing can be yours, and also anyone far off, anywhere who believes. How then can you explain the Cornelius thing in chapter 10, where the Holy Spirit has to twist his arm to get your butt over there to this Roman centurion and preach to him? Look, I'm sorry, I can't. I don't associate with a scum. How is that possible? Or how can Jesus have given the Great Commission to go out and missionize all the nations and have the Christians say, well, what, you actually went to speak with a Gentile? Are you out of your mind? You know, it's obvious that the statements of Jesus telling them to do it are the product of somebody trying to win that argument once it had come up.
It seems to me they're the very solution that they come to for this argument, to answer this argument, undercuts the actual existence of the argument in the first place. In other words, if Jesus had given the Great Commission to go out and spread the gospel to all the Gentiles, then why is Peter arguing with Paul? Why did that argument ever take place?
That's right. And so what do you have with, you got the Great Commission, go into all the nations. Well, the other side wasn't going to be outdone, so they fabricated Matthew 10:23. Don't go anywhere, or the 10 somewhere. Don't go among the villages of the Samaritans or the Gentiles, but only the lost sheep of Israel. Wait a minute. Why even bother saying that unless somebody is doing the opposite? So you have people, oh, yeah, you got a saying from Jesus. Well, I got one, too. Give me a minute.
What about the Samaritan woman who comes and Jesus says, you're not fit to be at my table?
Oh, God, that poor woman.
He's being a total jerk.
Jesus was a dick at that point.
Well, that's though he is. That's a kind of a form, the recurring form where Jesus is raising the bar. Like when he says to the guy with a demon possessed son, he says something like, "If you can, all things are possible to him who believes." And the poor sucker just says, "Lord, I do believe. Help my unbelief." Jesus is sort of testing him out with a Socratic pose. But still, it doesn't matter. Look at the outcome of that one. In Mark, it says, "Let the children first be fed." I was sent first to the house of Israel, but in Matthew, I think it is, he says, "It's the bread is not for the dogs, but for the kids. I was sent only to the house of Israel." Like, what happened there? I mean, somebody doesn't like the version they received. And so you have to ask, well, are these people lying about what Jesus said? I don't think they would have thought of it that way, though I don't care if they were, and we can't know. I think rather they're just amending an authoritative text like you'd amend the Constitution. They weren't really thinking of it as what Jesus said. It's just the charter document that needs to be amended.
Yeah, I mean, what all these arguments and contradictions and interpretations do is put an end to the fundamentalist Protestant idea of sola scriptura.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, if you take it to mean I don't need to read anything but the Bible, and I've known people like that, that is just ridiculous, and they're not doing it anyway because they're reading their church's theology into it.
Right,
massive
right.
harmonizations that were spoon-fed. But that's right, you would... I guess you could get around it by saying, as Martin Luther did. I mean, he propounded the sola scriptura thing, but he said you interpret it by the grammatico-historical method. You certainly do need to know the grammar and the original languages and the historical references just to fill in the gaps that the original readers didn't have a problem with. But so you could stretch it that way. That's pretty reasonable. But the problem is that you can't do what else Martin Luther did and start with the assumption that it's all going to agree and that it's going to be clear to any reader, which he did say. That's just obviously not the case.
Except, of course, for the Book of Mormon.
Of course, because that is the new dispensation. We all must be converted.
You got the same thing there. There are the differences in Christology in the Book of Mormon, for instance. It's not at all clear. I mean, there are different views given about the Trinitarianism or what? Subordinationism?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting to note, you can show how a lot of the Book of Mormon is based on specific Bible passages,
yeah.
And then you realize, well, gee, it's just what the New Testament did with the Old.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly.
Right, it's no different than what went before.
No, it isn't. If once you understand what biblical criticism says, you realize, yeah, that's the same method that the Joseph Smith used, and he's just doing what his predecessors did.
Yeah, this is the most recent of just examples of exactly what the New Testament did to the Old Testament.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the questions I had, now, Charlie and I have joked about this, but I mean, there are times in the New Testament where Jesus is literally a dick, and we like to look back at and the childhood texts on Jesus where, you know, his fingers are wrapped so he kills his teacher, that sort of thing.
Oh yeah, that's great. Yeah,
and I halfway wonder if some of those just like less known texts actually slip their way into the New Testament. I mean, hell, he walks by a fig tree out of season, doesn't have figs for him, and he kills the thing. I mean, seriously,
right.
He's a dick.
Yeah, it's obvious that the redactors are trying to mitigate that by making it implausibly into a lesson of faith. Peter says, holy mackerel, the thing withered on the spot. He says, and what you should draw from that is if you had faith, you could do the same thing because so-and-so, so-and-so. It's as if you can really hear the redactor trying to take your attention away. And then Luke changes it. He rejects it altogether and has instead a parable about a tree being uprooted and thrown into the sea, like the earlier version of a mountain. That's what he decides to get rid of it that way. But you've also got Luke 2, I think it is, where Jesus, as an adolescent, goes to the temple and his idiot parents don't know that he's not with them in the caravan. And they go back and say, oh my gosh, I thought he was with you. Let's go check. And so they're looking at all the video arcades and the comic book stores in Jerusalem. Where the heck is he? Well, last place I remember seeing him was in the temple. Well, let's go there. And so they do, and he's debating halakhic dialectic with the scribes, and they say, son, you've had us worried. And Jesus looks at him with disdain and says, why did you have to look? Where else would I be? And, okay, I'll come along quietly. And that's just like in all those infancy gospels where the parents of Jesus are shown as idiots, and Jesus has this godlike perspective where he can barely put up with them. And the same thing is true with the water into wine in John 2. This was originally a childhood gospel story. No disciples were in it. Jesus has done miracles to get adults out of a bind before. You can tell because when the idiot adults find they don't have enough wine for the wedding reception, why does Mary say, you know, they're out of wine? He says, what the concern of mine is that, woman? And there's that petulance like you have in the Gospels. And then she turns to the master of the feast and says, look, do whatever he tells you. He'll come through with something, because he always does. It's like reading the Superboy comic. And sure enough, he's all right, and he does the thing, and they're all shocked. That's just like when infancy Matthew Thomas, where Joseph is in the carpenter shop, and the poor blundering idiot can't get the legs on a chair he's building equal. And Jesus comes in and says, all right, you hold one end, I'll hold the other. And like a faith healer, he lengthens the legs. And so there's this constant thing where they're just the adults are idiots. Or you mentioned the tutor, ABC, and Jesus says, oh, I know that already. Can you tell me the Kabbalistic meaning of it? He hits him with the ruler, and Jesus blasts him, and there's loads of stuff like that. So it does creep into the New Testament. Or how about the thing with I love this one, where after the Transfiguration, they're trying to, the disciples are trying to exorcise this demon, and Jesus' eyes, he's like, what are you arguing about? We thought we could cast out a demon.
We could do it ourselves, yeah.
And he says, faithless generation, how long am I going to be with you? How long do I have to put up with you? I mean, that's Zeus come down to earth.
Yeah, and that story where Jesus was correcting Joseph's mistake by pulling and stretching the plank out of the correct length, that was kind of a turning point. You know, before then, Jesus' miracles were all, you know, acts of like evil. Like, he was killing children who bumped into him, and then the parents get angry at him, and Jesus makes the parents blind.
I mean, yeah.
Oh, God, those are hilarious.
Yeah, all the rest of the parents are getting mad at Joseph. They're saying stuff like, hey, Joseph, teach your kid to pray, not to curse.
Yeah. Yeah, that, and he says, look, you got to stop doing this. The people hate us. And he says, look, and he grabs him by the neck and says, if you knew who I am, you wouldn't even say this to me. It's enough that you speak to me. Don't touch me. Really amazing stuff.
Right. Amazing. Getting back to the canonical Gospels, the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, it's interesting, you know, how many of these events that kind of contradict each other that you read, and you read this stuff your entire life, but if you read it as it's presented in the New Testament, you know, you read Matthew first and you get that, you read Mark second, which, you know, they used to think that Mark was just this sort of abridged version of Matthew, you know, like the Reader's Digest version. It turns out that Mark was written first, actually.
Yeah.
But, you know, you read Matthew, then you read Mark, and you go over the same events, and you kind of have this idea that, oh, yeah, I remember that event from Matthew. And then you read it again in Luke, and it seemed to confirm this idea, this naive idea that you have, that all these Gospels are kind of agreeing with each other. But you have to kind of take the events and read them kind of side by side to actually even be aware of these contradictions at all. And a lot of people read these Gospels their entire lives and don't have any idea about this stuff.
Yeah, Bart Ehrman said that was the first thing that shook his fundamentalist faith when he looked at a Gospel Parallels book where they had the matching text side by side out of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and they match generally, but not specifically. And he said, geez, which one of these did Jesus say? And he realized it's simply out of the question to say that they're verbally inspired and inerrant.
Now, that brings up a good question. Is there anything in your opinion that actually does go back to Jesus in these Gospels, assuming, of course, that Jesus actually exists?
Yeah, we're still out on the did Jesus exist argument.
Well, the most convincing model, as far as I'm concerned, is that of S.G.F. Brandon, who wrote books like Jesus and the Zealots, where he says it looks like there are attempts, or extensive ones, in Mark, but really also in Luke, to distance Jesus from having been thought a revolutionary against Rome. Now, where did these rumors come from? Were they a misunderstanding, or was he actually someone like Theudas the Magician or Judas of Galilee or various other ones Josephus tells us about? And look at the cleansing of the temple. It says that he stopped anyone from bringing any vessels back into the temple. Well, the temple was huge, and that implies he occupied it. And there were temple guards always posted there, so that implies some kind of a battle. So either nothing happened, and Mark has just worked this up, trying to imagine what it would have looked like in utter ignorance of it, or he knew darn well what had happened, but has tried to reduce it to something where it just looks like Jesus is some nut turning over the tables in a church basement for rummage sale. So I find Brandon's argument pretty convincing, except for one thing. It seems to me the similarities to these other would-be messiahs and such that we read of in Josephus and Plutarch are... it seems to me more likely that they are the sources for the gospel stories rather than being spontaneous historical parallels. So I find that kind of blows that one out of the water, but if I'm wrong on that, that they've been copied by the gospel writers, then I'd say, yeah, Brandon's probably right. Jesus was a priestly revolutionary.
Yeah, it does seem, as the Gospels go on, they take more and more blame away from Pilate and put it onto the Jews.
Yeah.
Yeah, as you go on, the actual prejudices of the time that people were working on the things.
Right, and is it better at this time to, say, piss off the Jews, who already seem to be rejecting your message in droves, or, say, the Roman Empire, who has all the political and economic clout?
Yeah, so who are they going to play up to? And they kind of apparently envied the status Jews had as a privileged religion in the eyes of Rome and felt that they deserved it. And so that would be another reason to make Jews look bad and Romans look good.
Yeah, so it's in their best interest to say, hey, Rome, we're not revolutionaries. We're not trying to upset the apple cart here. You know, leave us alone.
Yeah.
But yeah. Then again, why would they be carrying swords then? And why would Jesus say, sell your garments, buy swords? I mean,
There's another one that Brandon pointed to. I suppose Luke could have just made this up because he wants to prepare for the application of the Isaiah 53 quote, he was numbered among transgressors. But that seems so contrived. That in itself sounds like an attempt to explain away the presence of the swords, which was already in Mark. You know, what's going on here? They're fighting for him, and so there's a lot to that. It makes a lot of sense. But on the other hand, there's yet another thing in the Mark 13, Matthew 24, Luke 21 apocalypse on the Mount of Olives. Jesus warns his hearers, or originally readers, not to be deceived and to think that any of the would-be messiahs and prophets are in the Jerusalem siege are the second coming of Jesus himself. Now that implies, I mean, you don't tell people to do what they're already not doing. That implies that in the writer's day, that was a problem that a lot of Christians said, Simon Bar Giora, that's Jesus returned. Or Simon Bar Kokhba in 132 AD, that's the second coming of Jesus. What more do you want? And we know that from Justin Martyr that Simon Bar Kokhba, who was supposed to be the Messiah, and did actually fight off Rome for about a year or so, issued his own coins, may have rebuilt the temple, etc., that he persecuted Christians that wouldn't accept him as the Messiah. Well, that implies some probably did, and that's probably who's in view in Mark 13. The people that said, well, this is the second coming of Jesus. So once you have that confusion made, then elements of these other would-be messiahs can start creeping back into the story of the historical Jesus. So he's already cleansing the temple of the laestoi, as Josephus says, Simon Bar-Gioris did. He's already being flogged before the procurator, but won't say anything, as Josephus says Jesus Ben Ananias did, and so on. So I really am distrustful as to whether any of that is original to Jesus, and if it isn't, then we're back to an unknowable, fictive Jesus.
Now, we're starting to run out of time a little bit here, but since you brought up Josephus, I do have one question. You know, there are two mentions of Jesus in Josephus. Now, there's almost universal consensus among scholars, as far as I know, about the second of the two mentions. But I want to talk about the first of the two, the Testimonium Flavianum. Because it seems to me that the consensus on that one, anyway, is that at best it is a partial interpolation. Well-meaning Christians who were copying this inserted some of their own ideas. But you have a lot of serious scholars saying, hey, if you strip away all the confessional aspects, you know, such as where he says that he is the Christ, if you say he is called the Christ, if you strip away all the overtly Christian stuff, you're left with what is possibly something that's real. And my point is, if you're going to strip away the confessional aspects of it, because it's obviously an interpolation, why don't you just toss the entire thing out?
That's what David Friedrich Strauss said. Once you see the point of a thing, the tendency of it, and discount that, you really have no reason to think there's any legitimate remainder left. There's no reason to believe the whole thing wasn't cooked up for that reason. It's like taking a bad text and making it into a good one. It's as if Ehrman and all these moderate guys said, well, this is disqualified for these various statements. Let's just get rid of them and accept it anyway. There's no reason for that.
Right. One of the reasons the scholars typically accept the 20.9.1 reference is that Origen, in the end of the second century, when he's arguing against Celsus, references that, you know, where they drag in James in front of the Sanhedrin. But somehow, even though he's very familiar with Josephus, he quotes him right and left, he totally misses the one thing that would have won the argument for him, you know, but somehow he totally missed it.
Yeah, he says one thing about Josephus we know, he didn't believe Jesus was the Christ. Well, then
right,
he must have been
exactly
reading this. The other thing, though, I think is even more likely to be an interpolation, because if you remove the thing about Jesus, well, you don't even have to do that. It seems like it's actually referring to the assassination of one contender for the high priest's office, who was the brother of Jesus, son of somebody or other else, who's mentioned elsewhere, and that it isn't about Jesus the Nazarene at all.
Right, you know, Jesus, Yeshua, Joshua, James, these are all extremely, extremely common names in the first century.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you bring up Jesus the Nazarene, because, you know, the big thesis of the incredible shrinking Son of Man is that, you know, the more we find out about this stuff, the less we feel comfortable saying that we know about this Jesus character. Case in point, his birthplace. You know, there's some passages still inside the New Testament that say Jesus the Nazorean, which, you know, like the Essenes, was a early first century cult.
Yeah, which we hear about elsewhere. And René Salm has done this astounding book, The Myth of Nazareth, where he goes over all archaeological evidence said to be from Nazareth. And he shows how even 1,000 years or two before the New Testament period, the Nazareth Plateau had been sporadically inhabited, but that there is no evidence of habitation there during the period Jesus is said to have lived. There's only graveyards and stuff, which people wouldn't live by. There's no evidence of this, but there is datable evidence that shows people had begun to resettle it around 50 AD. Now, that happens to be perfect for this old theory that when, if there was a Jesus, or at least when he's placed there historically, there was no Nazareth, but by the time the Gospels were written, there was. And that's why they thought it natural to say, oh, it means he's from Nazareth.
Yeah, it also gets back to the whole anxiety of influence thing, right?
Yeah,
because they didn't like the idea that he'd been a member of some sect. It's the same problem as him being a disciple of John the Baptist. Wait a minute, isn't he that? He's the Son of God. He knows everything already.
Well, you know, Charlie's actually right. We are running out of time, and I got to tell you, I've got a list sitting next to me, and I'm not even half through it, so I would love to have you back. But there is one question, and this is kind of a joke between Charlie and I. Now, you, I'm sure, know of Apollonius of Tyana. I mean, the arguments back and forth between Jesus' disciples and his over who is most divine.
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask about that, too.
Yeah, I knew you were going there, but you lost it.
Yeah, in this case, I'd say Apollonius wins, because in his confrontation with Rome, he didn't get crucified, he actually escaped.
Yeah, he's standing in front of Domitian, about to get his head handed to him, and he just vanishes into thin air, and then appears across the Mediterranean among his disciples, and they say to him, can this be true, or is it really you, or are you a ghost ascended from Persephone's realm? And he says, no, look, tell Damas, the chief disciple, to come and touch me and see I am no ghost from the netherworld. Well, now that's almost
exactly
just like Luke 24. And the point is, no, I didn't die. I'm not dead and returned. I cheated death. It's still me. Why isn't that what it means in Luke?
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, sorry, Leighton. I didn't mean to jump in there and take the thunder away from you. You had a question?
Oh, no. I mean, a fascinating topic. I'm not going to stop y'all from jumping in, but my question to you is, why is it we're following Jesus? He's crucified. Apollonius actually had the power to get away. I mean, personally, I'd follow Apollonius.
Absolutely.
Laura, some said that Jesus got away too. Or Marcion said that Jesus wasn't raised from the dead by the Father. He raised himself, as it still says in the Gospel of John.
Yeah,
but I'm sure. I mean, it's all institutional rivalries and all that kind of thing.
And of course, the most common Christian counter argument to that is that the sources we have for the biography of Apollonius of Tyana were written, you know, after the Gospels were already floating around, and so instead of Jesus copying Apollonius, this actually was a pagan response to the Christian Gospels or Christianity in general.
That's what Eusebius thought, and everybody likes to say that, but I say there is no evidence of literary borrowing. None of the stories are that close as they are, for instance, with the Widow of Nain and this Elijah story it's based on. You do not have the specific words or even plot elements. It's just the same sort of thing again and again. And that you find with the Gospels, Apollonius, Romulus, Empedocles, etc. It's the kind of thing, the wording is never that close, which it could easily have been if that's all Philostratus was doing.
Fascinating. Well, hey, it has been great having you on.
Yes, it has.
It's been so great that it's a shame to only spend an hour with you. We'd love to have you back on.
Sure, anytime.
Excellent.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, I mean, like Charlie said, we are out of time, but once again, we here at Irreligiosity would just, we bow down to you and we thank you for coming here, because we know about a tenth, if that, of what you know, so.
A tenth? I think you're vastly overestimating our knowledge. Bob, you got a doctorate in this stuff, don't you?
Oh, I have one PhD in New Testament, another in systematic theology.
Yeah, like I said, we know nothing compared to you.
I love the fact that you lost your faith right in the middle of pursuing a master's degree in the topic.
Yeah. Well, so did D.F. Strauss. He finished up his defense of the resurrection of Jesus, and as he finished the last word, he said he knew it wasn't true.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Again, thank you so much. We really enjoyed having you on.
Oh, for me too.
Yeah.
Talk to you again soon, I hope.